The following live broadcast of Tribbles in Ecstasy may not be suitable for all ages. The views expressed in this show are solely those of the individual providing them and do not represent the opinion of the station, website, or any affiliated partners. Audience discretion is advised. Now give it up for Warp 11.
And we are live on Kronos, First City, number 2. I was kind of pushing it there. I was finishing up I was finishing up one of the Foundry missions we're going to be talking about tonight. I just want to welcome you. I am Katsu. I want to welcome you to Tribbles in Ecstasy, number 81. Yes, where if you're anything like us, you're not at Star Trek Live at Las Vegas either. Not that's a good thing. It's sort of a bad thing. I feel really bad about it, but We have the opportunity to spend a little bit of time talking about stuff that we don't normally talk about, which is, of course, the Klingon side. I just want to finish up some little things on my side technically, and we will get rolling. Whoa, I'm walking on air. That's cool. All right, so tonight on the show, we got a kind of a thin cast, kind of how we've been doing it recently. We've got Skipper with us. How you doing tonight, sir?
I am well, sir. I hope it's a good show.
I know it'll be a good show, says me. So, that's a pardon some technical difficulties. Unfortunately, I'm still working on one screen. So, Xander keeps hitting me up, and he's like, "Matt, you gotta go to two screens, man. You gotta go to two screens." And I'm like, "I can't. I'm a municipal worker. They don't pay us a lot." So, all right, and Senor Woody Valley, how are you today?
I'm well, and you?
I'm kind of running around like a chicken with my head cut off. It's almost like I'm rushing to get this last thing done. I was at a technical conference for my job and all this week, so it's been kind of hectic getting everything in place last minute kind of deal. So I will kind of beg forgiveness a little bit here as we go in. So give me just one second to pull my show notes up, and we will get rolling. In the meantime,
beg for forgiveness on a Klingon? Oh, boy.
Forgiveness on a Klingon's like, I'm doing this. Here, enjoy some wonderful background music.
I'm actually going to do an official intro to this.
I've toyed with it. I've toyed with the idea of doing something like this. It'd been something for Tribbles, but Warp 11's just so damn fun. So, that was, of course, Michael Giacchino, who does all of the score for the last couple of Trek movies. That's, of course, the Star Trek the 2009 setup. So let's get into the news. Obviously, since last we saw you, Legacy of Romulus Devblog 36 came out, which is a new dilithium mine feature. I haven't had a chance to follow the link. What is the new dilithium mine feature?
I believe it's something to create some extra features on the outside in space of the of the rock you got the dilithium lime station at. Since you warp in, you know, you got the pet plane in the background. It got the rock with the base on it and stuff like that, and it was the station. So I believe it's something to create some dilithium effect around the rock.
So actual dilithium on the dilithium mine.
Yeah.
Whoa! Who knew?
Stuff you can't mine though.
Oh, awesome. So I'm looking forward to that after I get the other projects all started. So I've got the first two slotted on my FedSide fleet, but I can't keep up, you know. Again, that we've had that discussion numerous times with small fleets. I'm a cosmetic guy, so even though like I have like a tier 0 starbase or tier 1 starbase, but I've got all the cosmetics, it looks amazing, but it doesn't do anything. It's a lot like, you know, like most of the ships I have, really. It's just sort of like they look amazing, but they don't really do much. They're just kind of there. So anyway, the other big thing is the summer giveaway, which is happening. It starts on the 12th at 10 a.m. Pacific here in the U.S. And it will run until Friday the 16th. Brandflakes posted this up today. He'll be posting a news article a little bit later letting us know which item is free. Each day they'll post it up saying, hey, by the way, this is free. Hey, by the way, this is free. Hey, by the way, this is free. In the Zen store, it'll be the different items will be worth 0 Zen, and you can just pick them up and you'll be good with them. And it's going to be a different item every day, so you kind of have to be in every day. But it's going to be totally free. They'll waive the costs on it. You just go in and you click the claim button. So personally, I don't know what. We don't have the list, and unfortunately the guys at Las Vegas haven't been able to pry the list out of Brandflakes' hands yet. But personally, I'm hoping for, like, there's a couple of cosmetics, outfits I don't have yet. I wouldn't mind some of those. I wouldn't mind some bridges, you know, the spare bridge designs. But that's me. What are you looking for?
It's not terribly much out of the sea store that I want at the moment. Probably a costume or two. It's pretty much the main thing, you know, being Caspian and being very big fashionistas. Other than that, I'll just have to wait and see what entices me, basically.
All right, Skipper, what are you looking for?
I'm looking for outfits. Most of mine are only on my main. Everything else is kind of non-existent on the other tunes.
I do like the fact that it specifically says that whenever you claim it, it's an account-wide unlock. So hopefully, whenever they release each item, they'll be telling people what you know, what side it's eligible for, who can wear it, who can't wear it, that kind of thing. So personally, like, I've got all the KDF stuff except for the I keep saying void suits. I'm such a 40K nerd. But for the spacesuits, and I think I've got like the newer FedSide costumes I don't have, like the Voyager racing uniform. It just really didn't strike me as anything interesting at the time. So, but I personally want Dex, because I want to actually, like, part of what I like to do is I like to actually go onto my bridge, you know, and I want to see cool bridges. I don't want to see like generic wide open bridge that looks like it's a PvP zone, you know?
Yeah, it's understandable.
I miss the old bridge combat that players used to do randomly.
Well, see, the problem is I got into bridge combat with a friend of mine one time, and he thought that he had to, you know, I'm a tactical on pretty much every character I play, except for the few that I've done with the other branches to just kind of learn that play style. But like my default play style is tactical DPS. And so I talked him into bridge combat, and he thought he'd be cute getting up in my face with a rifle, and he was learning how wrong that idea was. And then he realized, wait a second, I'm a bunker engineer. So he found some corner and he set up his mortars and shields and everything else. And he was like, Matt, why don't you want to attack me all of a sudden? And I'm like, because you're stupid and I hate you. And come out here so I can shoot you in the face. And he's like, no. So it very quickly kind of ended once he realized he could bunker Fab. And it was just kind of over. So on that note, we're here in First Hall. I know last week we were on Vulcan, and we decided that the KDF didn't get enough love. And so we decided to pull out our Klingon characters and get out here and do some Klingon stuff. Have the two of y'all had a chance to go back and play through the 1 through 5 content, or the 1 through 21 content for the KDF side?
Only on doing triple test server. Still like being too busy trying to keep the dilithium and fleet marks up to get the all the fleet projects done and complete and stuff like that. Once I'm sort of like got a bit more free time with my character, with having the projects complete, I was going to go through and do it then. But what I've played back when it was on triple test server, it's been very good.
Awesome. What about you, Skipper? Okay. Well, I'm just I really like they haven't changed the format of First City at all, but they've changed why you're going to different places in First City, and I think that I really like the way First City's laid out. I think I like it better than the layout of Earth Space Dock. Unfortunately, I'm still not sure why Worf just stands out there just like a bump on a log, you know. I mean, I understand he's an older Klingon, but, you know, he could be doing something cooler with his time.
What, doing the combat or the exercises that the Klingons used to do?
Yeah, like, I think he could be out there. I think he could be out there doing, like, a Mokbara thing, like, leading a Mokbara thing with a bunch of Klingon warriors or whatever. Or, you know, something other than just kind of standing there. Of course, that's also...
Gonna be a Klingon and instruct war.
I mean, especially with the war, you know, with the whole Federation, you know, the whole KDF Fed side struggle going on in storyline. We haven't seen much of it because we're busy, you know, putting the Romulans into the game and then putting the Iconians into the, you know, trying to do more stuff with the Iconians and all this other stuff. But I wouldn't mind if the Federation and the Klingons are really at war. I'd rather, you know, I'd like to start seeing more of that, you know, and in which case, you know, Worf's stuff would become invaluable, you know. So at any rate, we did a couple Foundry missions this week. I'll be honest, I was just finished running the KDF mission, but I didn't touch the Fed mission at all because of just, you know, real life being in the way. So Woody, why don't you tell us about the Fed mission, and then we'll both jump in and talk about the KDF side mission.
Yeah, sure. This particular mission on the Fed side is called Unlucky 7 by Navi Slayer, I believe that's correct in pronouncing. Its story is just... rather plain, simple story where pressing the control button and making me screen go bigger and all that. It's a bit of a out of the box sort of mission. Rather plain, simple in approach to it. It's a good start because this is actually a debut mission for this particular author, so it's a good little starting platform. Just a basic outline story. It's sort of like you go to check out a certain system. Some of your bridge officers were starting to have this like weird feeling that something's not right. You know, that gut feeling type of thing, and it's sort of like got that twilight sign type feeling where you seem to have some weird things happen, and you try to get yourself back out of it and stuff like that. So, and it all evolves around the number 7. So, yeah, it's definitely a good start. It's just probably the only real thing is just some small grammar and spelling mistakes. There's a couple of places where he starts off a paragraph without a capital letter in the dialogue, but all in all, it's kind of reasonably good mission. It gives over 1,000 dilithium too, so definitely worth playing, and hopefully encouraging him to keep working on the foundry.
Awesome. I just finished Warrior's Honor, which is a KDF foundry mission we did. Warrior's Honor by Mr. Identical, Mr. Identical, IDENTICAL. The story setup, again, this is a first time author, so we're pleased to put him up here and to talk about him. Warrior's Honor, you get called up because your family has been challenged, or your honor has been called into question. Very Klingon intro reason to go and run a mission. And from there, you go through a series of very Klingon-esque scenarios. And, it finally leads up to this epic space battle over the local space around Kronos, and it's this really cool gig. So I recommend, it's a good starting thing. I do have a couple of issues with it that I have put into the review. My review issues are that I don't need to hear the word Patok every text box. Also, if you're going to address, the thing is this, with Federation is all about, the Federation missions can be about hubris, because the Federation, the thing about the gig about the Federation is they are the good guys. They're the Boy Scout. But the problem is they can be so Boy Scout and so goody goody that it ends up being kind of this radical extreme, or they start taking radical measures. The thing about the Klingons is that the Klingons are very much about, their kind of warrior pride, and it's about telling epic stories. Like I tell people all the time, the Federation missions are like, yay, let's go defend this world. The storyline missions, not just the Foundry, but the storyline missions for Fed are very kind of, hey, let's defend this world. Whereas the Klingons they're pirates, they're Vikings. They're like, let's go off and storm this castle and blow up Rurapente and assault the gates of hell, because these things are epic stories, right? And the thing is, it's harder to get, in my opinion, it's harder to get on content right, because you really have to know the way that a Klingon thinks, which isn't exactly the way that we think. And I think that the issue with A Warrior's Honor is that you can see I can see a good Klingon story in this story. What I don't see is a person who knows enough about the Klingon mythos and mythology and whatnot in order to make that story convincing. That's my take on it. Some of the times, like Woody, I was running it with Woody on, in TeamSpeak with us, and periodically I'd be like, wait, what? Huh? but that's my take on it. Woody, what was your spin on this?
Yeah, he tried to keep his best to keep a like kid Klingon on top of storyline to it. Some places might be a bit too much, some places might not be not quite enough. It's more the technical side of things. Like, you beam down to the first ground map there, it's, you beam right on top of a table and stuff like that, not beaming off to like one side that's like on the ground.
Plus the away team actually beams down into like the other end of the map or whatever.
Yeah, that seems like to be more of a bug or something like that with that sort of thing. But yeah, just it could easily be adjusted. You know, just move the spawn point just off to one side or to the one side of the table or something like that. You know, so it's not actually on the table when you're starting off there and stuff like that. And it's same at the end of the mission. Goes to the ready room and stuff like that, and he beams, starts his point on the top of the table there. So it's very, seems to be like just a little bit of carelessness about that sort of thing. If you look at other Foundry missions, stuff like that, they'd probably have a bit more attention to that. Just seems like he's just rushing it to put something out so he can get dilithium tips. Something like that, you know, but he's probably not helping himself in any big way. But all in all, the story was, you know, reasonably good. Probably the only thing is was towards the end, it was they had a big battle over Kronos against the Federation, and the Federation don't seem to do a big, massive, like, take over the world, especially try to take over Kronos like that. You know, it'd probably be better if it was some sort of like in-house civil war type of thing, more than just knocking off feds. And some people might like it, especially the amount of ships you've got to destroy. If you're very trigger happy with your ship, you can easily pick up some loot drops there, so which everyone seems to like these days. Yeah, so hopefully you can take what we have on board and try and spend some good quality time in the mission just to, you know, do some minor repairs to it, you know, improve it a bit. And hopefully this could be taken well by reviewers.
Oh, yeah. My biggest thing is, Ed, this sounds so random and so weird, but at some point when you're having like a talk down with the big baddie, I really wish that either you or he would use the Klingon phrase, "The wind does not respect a fool." Like, I don't know why that's something that I think would really enhance that mission, but just the, you know, especially given the things that have gone on in the storyline. And I don't want to spoil this, because what I will say is, you know, it sounds like we're coming down on this author. Like, I really, you know, once I kind of put my head where I think his head was, and understood his design logic, because that was something I learned in university, was, you know, whenever you're dealing with a writer or an author, you know, put your head in their headspace, you know, figure out where they're coming from, because at that point, because it may not make sense to me, but if I start thinking about it the way they're thinking about it, it'll make total sense to me. So once I kind of got my head into where he was trying to go with it, and once I got past, there are a couple of spots where I feel the language is a little flippant, you know, or maybe it could have been made more Klingon sounding. But once I kind of learned to filter through that, it's actually a really engaging story, which is why I don't want to spoil it, even though it sounds critical of us. But there were some technical issues that need to be addressed, as well as, a better functional knowledge of KDF, if you're going to write KDF content, would need to be involved. But that's, again, that's our perspective. We like to step in and, you know, give people our opinions on what we think about these Foundry missions. We want to make sure that the best Foundry missions are being played by the best people, and we think that these missions were definitely worth playing. They may just need a little bit of fine tuning and tweaking, and for first attempts they were really awesome. So the standard disclaimer that we give here is that we want to review not the spotlight missions, we want to review missions that maybe don't get a lot of airplay or maybe first time posters, so that we can kind of showcase some of the stuff that maybe you're not catching or maybe you're missing in the, you know, you see the obvious Foundry missions, but maybe there's some other stuff, some hidden gems we want to find for you. So definitely stay tuned. If you find any of these kind of missions, definitely email us or Twitter Both our Twitter is at TribblesInXTC. Our email address is TribblesInXTC at sweetmedia.com. If you have any other questions or issues, definitely direct them to that, direct to myself, KatsuTSW on Twitter. And we can definitely work some things out and get some things started away. So, next up, we're just going to cover this really quickly. The 60 Minutes Australia ran a spot on on Voyager 1 and 2. How in this week in 1977, NASA launched Voyager, the two Voyager space probes from Cape Canaveral. They were to last 5 years, and they sent them on a journey to explore Jupiter and Saturn. Well, they did such a good job that they just left them out there and kept recording. As of now, 36 years later, Voyager 1 is 18 billion kilometers from Earth. It is by far the furthest man-made object that has ever traveled from Earth. In fact, some scientists... we covered this. I think we discussed Voyager last week or the week before, how it's approaching the edge of it's entering interstellar space, where basically the sun's gravity no longer has as much a hold on it as the gravity of other celestial bodies in the galaxy itself. It's really cool because the reporter who submitted was a guy by the name of Ray Martin, who actually was at the 77 Voyager launches, and he kind of gave his perspective about space programs gone on. And it's also talking about putting yourself in that headspace, not being Australian. I didn't really get a chance. This is the first time I've really seen a foreign perspective on the U.S. space program. So it kind of gave me look at that, you know. Did either of y'all get a chance to catch that 60 Minutes clip?
Yeah, well, I was the one that actually found it because, you know, with my accent, you probably know where I'm from.
But, Where are you from?
New Zealand.
You're from the Shire?
That's it. Well, I found this because I was actually watching it on last Sunday when it aired. It was also interviewing Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks leader that's held up in the embassy in London. They were interviewing him too, so they had this story as well. And I said, that's quite an interesting story. We might actually put that with the this week's show. So I'm glad you seem to like it there.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm a big. I've said it before on the show. I'm a big sci-fi nerd, and so anytime I have the ability to be like, wait, there's this other stuff, you know. Especially with, especially since Voyager is very specifically, I think we've discussed this before, but Voyager is one of the inspirations for V'ger. It's an obvious reference to V'ger. But, the whole Voyager program ties into very early Star Trek and how it, and even into later Star Trek like the Borg. So, clearly, you know, yeah. Like all that stuff right there. Yeah.
Yeah. And just so you know, the news reporter, Ray Martin, he's been in the business for a good 40 years, you know, doing news reports and stuff like that. And he's a multiple Gold Logie winner, which is like Australia's version of the, I think it was the Emmys. You, that's your television awards over there?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he's well respected. So it's a good... good news report. It's not exactly a reading news report. It's actually a video news report. So if you click on the show notes, click on the link, you will actually watch it more than read it. So it's good stuff.
Oh yeah. Also, we see. That's really our science thing. We, you know, there's not really a lot of science stuff we dug up recently. I know that there's a guy out there who's managed to 3D print the exterior of an Aston Martin, and he's just wanting to put the internals together and to actually drive a 3D printed Aston Martin, which I think will be kind of cool. But unfortunately, no Trek tech coming out of this, because most of the Trek people, most of the brains that Star Trek have inspired and vice versa, are at Star Trek Las Vegas, which is in Las Vegas, Nevada, here in the U.S. And that's you can go to creationent.com. I think it's like /cal/whatever, you know. But you go to Creation Entertainment, or you go to StarTrek.com, and you can find out all about Star Trek Las Vegas, which basically I was running down the guests, just the guests, that are there. It's like 108 of them, and it's like everybody that's still breathing in the Star Trek franchise. They dragged them out here to Las Vegas. Each one of them has their own booth, and they're supporting different causes. I think if I remember right, Gates McFadden is running a charity out of her booth, which is really cool. Or she's got some stuff that she's been kind of auctioning off, and the proceeds go to, you know, the arts or whatever. I was following her, reading on her Twitter feed, something to that effect. But also, people like Joel, what killed me, what tripped me out was Joel Grey, which I know from Cabaret. But he's done episodes of Star Trek, and apparently, like, he and Patrick Stewart are now like really close friends, and was gonna, like, Joel Grey was gonna be his best man at Patrick Stewart's wedding and stuff. So I know that StarTrek.com has an article on the first like a number of different things that have occurred in day one of the convention. I know it's set to go for another couple of days, and just everybody and other is there already. It's a huge thing, and unfortunately, almost every single talk show, internet talk show and podcast covering Star Trek Online and Star Trek in general have some presence there. Unfortunately, due to the relaunch and due to schedules here at Holosuite Media, we weren't able to put a person on the ground this year. I know that there are a number of us planning to go for next year, and we will probably be broadcasting live from there next year. So that's the game plan.
2016 for me, I'm planning for.
See that? 2 years in a row. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about broadcasting for 2 years in a row.
Yeah, well, mostly for me, trying to get there for 2016, because it'll be also the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. So it's just making it sort of like extra special for me to go over then.
Oh, yeah, that'll definitely be cool. And we have another 50th anniversary to talk about here in a little bit too.
That will definitely be a big one. So.
Oh yeah.
Just a side note too, Warriors Best is send congratulations to Captain Gecko, Elvira, and his wife for doing their marriage new vows at the convention at the Enterprise Bridge there with Denise Crosby affiliating it.
So saw that. That was really cool.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, pass on that congratulations for doing that.
Yeah, definitely. Congratulations.
Wish them all the best with their marriage and all that.
Oh yeah, no doubt. Speaking of StarTrek.com, StarTrek.com has put forward a poll. It's still ongoing. This isn't a. Normally, I like to report the closed polls. That way, we're not skewing anything. But this one, I think, is kind of It can be polarizing. And the question is, who is Star Trek's most intimidating villain? The options that they have up are Khan, the Borg, Gul Dukat, Q, Luther Sloan, and the Gorn. And I'll be honest, when I looked at this, I don't even know who Luther Sloan is. I might have missed it or not caught him. Do y'all remember who this guy is?
I don't. Mind you, I haven't exactly seen every single episode of Star Trek out there yet, so...
Well, how dare you, sir? Go back and watch them all now. No.
Well, I've got the Enterprise, and I think I'm back, have enough money there to go get the complete series of the TOS, so...
See, this is what I... See, this is why I'm a huge fan of Netflix, because they've got all the seasons, all the show, all the series, all the seasons, all in the all for streaming. So it's like,
unfortunately, with my, as you can tell by my accent, I can't get Netflix over here.
Well, there's bound to be them. I would demand it. I would demand it of them. Be like, I need. You don't understand. I need Star Trek. Just give me the Star Trek, and we'll be cool. No one gets hurt. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm working towards getting something on the putting something on the shelf. So at least I got them there available and ready.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I know that unfortunately we are kind of. I've posted up the current percentages, so we sort of know what the current percentages are at StarTrek.com, but I'm just going to ask, so Skipper, of that list, man, who is, in your opinion, the most intimidating overall villain in the Star Trek universe?
Classically, I'll say the Borg, because that's not one person, it's a group, and it's hard to stop an entire group of something coming for you.
Yeah, I find it actually, because it's, the question is, him entailing villain, and the Borg are villains, you know, and so but I find it very strange to actually
technically, the question. Well, see, here's the thing, like, I could see that case with the Gorn, because the Gorn are each individual, but the Borg is all in one. Like, there is the Queen that represents the sum totality of the Borg collective, but they are all one creature, you know, for lack of a better phrase, one entity. They all operate harmoniously within each other. In fact, the biggest problems is that when individuality has been introduced into the book, into the collective. So, like, I could see why they're putting the Borg up there as a villain, as opposed to a bunch of villains. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but how do you just stop that? How would you stop that particular villain? Is in my eye, that one keeps regenerating and keeps coming back. Maybe a little different, but it's always going to be the Borg.
Yeah, they adapt. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, that's why I definitely put them up as Star Trek's most intimidating villain when not turned into. I'm not gonna say comedic relief, but when not marginalized. Because there are episodes of you know, Voyager and particularly Voyager, because Voyager has the most contact with the Borg. Like, they're a threat, but like, Janeway's capable of staring them down. So really, how tough can they be? You know,
If you look at it, there's different types of Borg. There's the Borg from the movie, which are unstoppable. There's the Borg from Voyager, which are human-like, and you can take them out individually or as a group. Or there's even the weaker Borg, which are on, Enterprise? They were the weakest of all.
True. The thing is this, like, the moment, and I guess it's because I'm a Shadowrun nerd and I'm a, you know, other different sci-fi series nerd. The moment I found out about the Borg and their energy adaptation, I would have brought flechette weapons back into use. Yes, they're inhumane, but that's... They can't adapt to flechettes. Like, tiny little needles shot through people. And it doesn't breach the hull. Very effective. You know?
Do you remember Stargate? Race called the Replicators?
I think I saw, like, three or four episodes with those, yeah.
Whatever they adapted or whatever they took over... with what they were mostly made of. And that made them either weak or strong. So the more advanced they were, like, say if they came across the E or some super intelligent race and took their technology, that is what you would face. If they came across, say, an old steam engine and they chew that up, then that you'd be facing something made of cast iron or tin.
And literally, rusty.
Yeah, literally, that's that particular race. So I look at the Borg the same way.
See, like... No, go ahead.
Well, the Borg are everywhere, but they're also isolated. They even said point blank, certain areas the Borg can't communicate, and their lines of communications are broken up by zones. Or, what was it, the warp conduits or the Borg conduits were the only way of communicating?
Yeah, well, the transwarp net, but there's a number of, you know, yeah, there are a number of instances. Like, I remember there's a Voyager, I think it's a Voyager episode where they... Yeah, because Chakotay gets, like, really dangerously injured or whatever, and they have to technically, they have to bring him into, it's not called the Collective, it's called, like, the Consortium or the Council or something like that. It's another
sliver. It was a group of the Borg that offshooted from it.
Because they were out of contact. And they were out of contact, they couldn't figure out what to do, and so they did the thing that makes the most sense to the Borg, they reconnected themselves to a self-contained collective. Yeah, I don't remember what they called themselves.
Well, there was Next Gen, there was Hugh, there was a couple from Voyager, and that literally tells you the Borg are broken up by zone and location, so that was what you would face.
I'm remembering for Voyager there that they had those children that were trying to adapt and get themselves back in the collective and stuff like that.
So, but there are a couple of really good ones up here. Like I said, Luther Sloan, I have no idea who that is. I don't even know. The Gorn, I didn't really see a threat to the Gorn. Like, they showed up, I think, they've shown up maybe a half dozen times in between movie and TV show, and they haven't really. I mean, the most exposure I've ever had to the Gorn is STO, and even then we don't talk about their culture very much. We talk about Klingon culture. So, then of course, you got Khan, Goldacott, and Q, and honestly, I don't know about y'all, but I took Q completely off the list because he's not. First off, he's not really a villain. He's just an antagonist. And there's a literary difference. You're dealing with literary semantics at that point. But, you know, Q is always obnoxious, but I really think that Q is Prometheus and Lucifer, not Lucifer, Loki. You know, like, he's there to elevate man, but he's doing it in a very kind of adversarial way. Because he knows that he's adversarial by nature. So, like, I never really see him as a villain. It's just more a, okay, what morality tale are you trying to tell now, Q? You know? I don't know if y'all have that same impression of Q, but that's the impression I've always gotten of Q. Okay.
Q, well, Q is a race. If you go Q, the individual who was the judge, who always went to Next Gen, and sometimes Voyager and Deep Space Nine, that is a little bit different. I mean, we're still talking about an individual's behavior, not a collective or a group, like the Gorn or the Borg. If you talk about Khan and you talk about all the augments, that will be a different thing.
And for the record, Q went to DS9 exactly once, and he got jawed by Sisko, and he never came back. So all I'm saying is, maybe we should have just punched that dude a little more. That's all I'm saying. John Delancey, great actor. Maybe we should have jawed Q a little bit more and we wouldn't have had as many problems. And of course, like, Khan was up there. Khan was, like, the number one option to pick. It's not the number one poll result. But, you know, he's intimidating. But, like, in the original series, like, let me back up. The only Khan that I have found intimidating is the Cumberbatch Khan. You know, because he just has that kind of brooding menace. In Space Seed and in Space Seed, Khan is that very kind of self-assured fantasy island kind of, like, guy that walks around with swagger because he can, and he's not really intimidating because he's matched up against Kirk, who's just as arrogant and obnoxious as Khan is. So, and then in the movie, in Wrath of Khan, we're not dealing with Khan, the incredibly collected, you know, very brilliant, you know, dangerous predator. We're dealing with Khan, the guy who's been driven crazy. And he's dangerous, but at this point he's lost a lot of his teeth in my opinion. Whereas the reboot Khan is much more cerebral in his evil, in his quote unquote evil. Because I still believe that he's, you know, in the reboot, I still think he's an antagonist more than a villain. But he's still got that brooding, intelligent menace. And he's not that, well, I was a king back in the day, and I do not know what you're talking about. You know, he's very that, these people used me, I'm going to put them through the floor, and I'm going to do the things that they won't do in order to accomplish that end. And that to me, that's intimidating, and he's really a villain in the movie, but he's also got that, like, maybe he's not the bad guy kind of deal. I don't know. Khan has always been a very dense, deep character for kind of chewing through. Gul Dukat was a weird one, because, like, at first, sort of the play opposite of Sisko, kind of the foil, but then he, you know, then he starts going full on, you know, full on deep end, you know what I'm saying, with the whole paw race.
He breaks down after the death. He breaks down after his daughter's death. He breaks down.
Yeah, and mentally. Again, yeah, and again, that's one of the cases of, you know, yeah. Like with Khan, you know, Khan loses his brain and suddenly he's just kind of off the deep end and gone, you know.
Yeah, I'm watching a bit of Deep Space Nine on the one of the commercial televisions over here, and I watched an episode of with Gul Dukat goes off with the Bajoran Major, can't remember her name, and went off to find a slave transport ship that crashed, and found out the brain was involved and needed them to mine dilithium. I can't remember the name of the episode. I didn't see, but it's sort of like seeing that. It's sort of like he's not all that intimidating because he literally became like jelly when time come to them making a choice of killing his daughter or taking her home back to Cardassia. So you know, he's not. I find him not that. Very intimidating. He might have been with his past when he was in command of the Deep Space Nine station, but when the times are changing and stuff like that, it doesn't seem to be so intimidating.
True. Like, and this is the thing. Like, and this is my opinion, purely my opinion, as we say at the beginning and end of every show. Like. I've always felt that Deep Space Nine was a direct reaction to Babylon 5. I always feel that way. I always have. And Dukat always struck me as kind of a junior league version of Jakar. I don't know whether y'all have ever made a similar connection or whatever, but like as opposed to him being the oppressed people. He's part of the oppressor, but he's still got that kind of Shakespearean swagger about him, you know? And the difference is, you know, like, Dukat gets eaten up for the death of his, you know, the death of his daughter. Not even so much, I mean, the loss of his people because of the Old Dominion War, it bugs him, but his daughter is really personal and strikes home, whereas for Jakar, like, it's the whole loss of his people. It's a very similar storyline. But the difference is, you know, Jakar keeps turning to the light and Dukat keeps turning to the dark, you know? And like I said, that may just be me and I may be off in left field, but...
Wasn't Jakar the reptile race in Babylon 5
that was
enslaved
by
the other ones?
Like I said, it's sort of a flip-flop because in Babylon 5, the Centauri are kind of the fascists that enslaved the whole race. Whereas in the and they enslaved the reptilian race, which were the Narn. Whereas in Deep Space Nine, it's the Cardassians who are the sort of reptilian race, who are the oppressors of the Bajorans, who are the kind of spiritual race that's humanoid. Which ironically, in Bab 5, the reptilian Narns are the more spiritual race. So it's sort of this. The parallel is very, very similar and very, very eerie, to me at least, because like I said, I continue to maintain that DS9, because DS9 came out at about the same time as Bab 5, and now granted, the storylines are radically different, the writing's radically different, in my opinion, Straczynski knocked it completely out of the park and did a much better show, but that, I always draw that parallel between Jakar and Dukat, except for, like I said, Jakar keeps focusing, despite torture, despite torment, despite all this other stuff, he keeps focusing on the light, whereas Dukat kind of lets himself get drawn into the darkness, you know. There's little parallels here and there, and the fact that they both occur in a space station, you know, it was just very eerily similar when I was growing up. I noticed that, so kind of formed my opinions. As for who we talked about, this is all come off the poll. Rather than tell you who won the poll, because the poll's actually ongoing, I recommend going to StarTrek.com and going ahead and actually answering the poll, finding out for yourself. Maybe you can sway opinion, or maybe you can, you know, chime in and definitely participate in the Star Trek forums. So we were talking earlier about the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. As those of you in the nerd community may know, through something completely different, right? Matt Smith Smith stepped off stepped out of the TARDIS, a couple months ago? He's going to be there for the 50th anniversary and for the Christmas special, but he announced he was leaving a couple of months ago. And there's been this big, who's going to be the Doctor, who's going to be the Doctor? Well, unless you've been living under a rock, you now know that the new Doctor is Peter Capaldi, who is a BAFTA award-winning actor. He is much older than Tennant and Smith, and he is very much like, and a number of BBC sources have made this mention, that Capaldi and Tennant and this wave of actors are people who grew up on Doctor Who, you know, as opposed to people who are having to figure out what Doctor Who was. These guys are dedicated nerds, you know, for lack of a better phrase, and they're, you know, they have their own favorite Doctor. You know, Matt Smith actually had to go back and watch Doctor Who to find, but Tennant has actively, avidly said that 4 has always been his, and Capaldi has gone forward to say that Patrick Troughton, the second Doctor, was his, because you know, he's the first Doctor who actually regenerated into a new Doctor, and you know, the show could have really fallen apart right there. So he thinks that Troughton did a really good job bridging that gap and turning it into a franchise instead of just a one-off, you know. What do y'all think about Capaldi being made, apart from the fact that he can't swear, what do y'all think about his appointment as the new Doctor?
It's hard to tell for me, because I haven't really seen very much of his work. I've heard he's in some sort of award-winning British comedy of sorts, comedy drama, but so it'll be pretty interesting to see what he's got for the character.
I'll be pretty surprised to see if they follow the line of the original Doctor, because the 12th is supposed to be the darkest and the cruelest of the Doctors. He's supposed to be the hardest, coldest. He's the finale and he's the death, and pretty much he became worse than the Master in the very end, according to the series.
Yes, the Veilyard. Yes. In fact, that's all covered in the Trial of the Time Lord. They talk about how the Veilyard is the Doctor's last incarnation, and he's basically the complete, like you said, he's the complete inverse of everything that the Doctor has been, you know. Or not necessarily evil, but ruthless kind of deal. And
They described him as cruel, heartless, and the Doctor that did not care. And when you saw the Matt Smith's finale one, where he actually sees where he's buried or what's left of the TARDIS and stuff, you see the bearded future version of him at the same location.
Yeah, the John Hurt, the Doctor that's John Hurt,
Didn't he say at that moment that he was the Doctor that wasn't?
He is listed as the Lost Doctor. And that's how he's credited, if I remember right. The issue is there's some theories here, because we don't have 100% confirmation that, because the Doctors have all kind of known relatively within order who they are. The gap that we don't have is for between McGann and Eccleston. Like, we don't know for sure that McGann handed the baton to Eccleston. There might have been an intermediary during the Time War itself. So there's a train of thought that believes that the John Hurt doctor, or the John Hurt, I'm going to call him the John Hurt doctor, the lost doctor, is actually the doctor that participated in the Time War. And then he regenerated to pull himself out of the Time War and to time lock it, which is when he turned into Eccleston. We don't know for sure, but that's one train of thought. The other train of thought is, of course, that John Hurt is the Veilyard. Just because having John Hurt be the Veilyard doesn't completely change the regeneration. Because if that were the case, if John, going back to that original train of thought where he was the Time Lord during the time, he was the Doctor during the Time War, then that would push the numbers back, and that would mean that technically Capaldi isn't part of Cycles, you know. So if he's afterwards, like, we don't really know, and we won't know Christmas, where this fits in and how this plays out. Personally, I'm not a big fan of Stephen Moffat, his interpretation of the Doctor. I think he's gone progressively further afield, and he's basically turned the Doctor into a Mary Sue at every possible opportunity, which is where I'm concerned about Capaldi. But what I'm positive about him.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Have you seen the incident involving the Dark and Light Guardian with the Doctor?
Refresh my memory.
There was a White Guardian, there was a Dark Guardian, and every so often there was a game involving everything and everything, be it good or evil, to occur everywhere at one moment. There is always enlightenment to be fought for, or a prize. The Key of Time, I forget what that one was called, but enlightenment was the prize with one of the other Doctors.
This is Classic Who, right?
This is Classic Who, but they both also touch on that the Doctor was going to receive something from the Guardians at some given point, because he has to serve them 3 times. He has only done 2.
Gotcha. And Capaldi actually has he's been a long-time Doctor Who fan, so he could very well be bringing a lot of that. Okay, guys, let's bring this around. You know, because if they're gonna pull the Doctor out of the 12 regeneration cycle, they're gonna have to figure out a way to do that so that they can obviously keep the show going. Because the one thing you don't do is you don't pull the trigger on your breadwinner, you know. But Capaldi has a deep love and respect for the Doctor, because, like, I mean, come on, when he was announced, he came out and he did the lapel thing that was made very famous by the first Doctor. So.
What would be the biggest thing that they would offer someone at the very end of their life or their race's life, if they could bring it all back or restart everything from one moment?
Well, see, the problem is, like, if making this a very Doctor-specific question, like, with Tennant got to see the Time Lords come back and what they would do, and that's when he put them back in their hole. You know, like, he knew what they would be up to. So I would say,
but that was the Time Lords from the time of the war. There is still the genetic bank of all the Time Lords. Everything that they were, every piece of them, everything that you could regenerate is in there, also with the Arc of Infinity and the power of the Time Lords. Eye of Harmony.
So you're suggesting that maybe the Doctor have the ability to go back before the Time War and work some Wuji or fix it?
It may get to a point where his race is reborn from a sacrifice. Some are saying at the end of the Doctor, when he dies, he actually brings back his race, but from an earlier point. And he is part of it, and so is the Master again. Because that is the cycle of the Time Lords themselves. They keep coming back over and over and reliving, correct?
True. So, like, in macro, you're, like, regenerating the race that regenerates kind of deal. Okay.
Well, that's what the Eye of Harmony is. It's time itself. They were literally living within a neutral point. They were not supposed to grow old, but they did. This could be that the bodies wore out. But the problem is, you don't know the extent of that for that race. Did it count as a life, or did it just give them infinite lives medically? Or, like, at one point you saw a female Time Lord choose her body. Literally go through, like, clothes and choose a body or host or whatever.
Oh yeah, and in Matt Smith's doctor, you know, River says she's focusing on a dress size, you know.
Ah.
So it'll be a unusual end for the Doctor. You don't know if it's going to end the series or start it all off again for the newer generation.
Note to self, don't sit idle for 60 minutes. I should have been dancing. Now you can see the login screen with all my cool characters, guys. That's pretty awesome. Yeah, so definitely something that I'm looking forward to in Christmas is that. Of course, I'm also, like, long before that, Ender's Game's coming out, and I'm kind of twitching at that. I can't wait to see it. A little depressed at the trailers, but that's that's kind of my personal gig, which is something we can always talk about when, you know, future episodes. Hear, hear. All right. So I think I bounced into a different instance from y'all. Oh well. We're about in an hour now, so this is a good place. We've run through our notes. Everything's been good. I want to thank Skipper and Woody for hanging out with me today, and for definitely contributing in and making sure that we've got everything set up going forward for all the excitement that's going on with the free weekend. I can't wait to talk to y'all about the stuff that we've picked up next week, you know, because next, that's when it's all going to go down. We're going to be able to talk about all the cool stuff that we've been able to pick up from them. So definitely, I recommend jumping in, get your free stuff from the Zen store. Meet us back here on Friday, where we're going to talk about all the cool stuff that happened in the Zen store. And, kind of speculate on what's going on there. Of course, we'll have another dev blog for y'all. We'll have the complete post wrap from Vegas. And I'm looking to have some more people on. I know Alistair wanted to come roll with us, but he's not been feeling the best. And Xander, of course, wanted to be with us, but he's got some personal stuff he was taking care of as well. So I just want to say, from the cast of Holosuite Media, from the staff of Holosuite Media, thank y'all very much for tuning in. And I think we are going to get out of here with some Warp 11.
Hey, everyone.
Captain Kirk and Vigadin, nicotine and Romulans, TNG and THC, Captain Pike and PCP. Drink until the bottle's dry, and overdose will milk your lie. Another night of troubles and ecstasy. Drugs and mescaline, hairy mud and heroin, Deanna Troi and Dexatrim, Bones McCoy and opium, Demerol to Boligo, amphetamines to make it so. Another night of tribbles and ecstasy.